Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post a Zolt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post as Amaron at DungeonsMaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week. So this week, we are going to talk about D&D Encounters Season 10, Council of Spiders, Session 1, Survivors. But before we start this week's recap of what happened at our table, we're just going to give you a little bit of a background regarding what happens or why they're back in Mezzobranzan and why the parties are back, why they're playing Drow, etc., etc. With the reincarnation of the Avatar of Loth, basically this new avatar is looking for a little more power. So now what is happening is Loth has commanded her priestesses to actually acquire a lot of, what was it we talked about, Derek? Magic? Acquire a lot of the arcane magic?
Yes, yeah, she's trying to recreate Mistra's old, like in the previous third edition Dungeons & Dragons, Mistra had the magical weave that was the force of all arcane energy. Loth is trying to gain that power because when the spell plague hit, the weave sort of was destroyed. So Loth's goal behind the scenes is that she's trying to create what she's calling the demon weave, where she's going to reform it in her own chaotic image, and then usurp that power away from whoever's got it now, which I don't think is anyone, and basically raise her status as a greater goddess.
Great. So we have three drow. So basically you're summoned into Mezzobranzan to do a little chore to reestablish the demon weave for the priestesses. Now there's three drow that are working together. One is an actual priestess. Her name is Priestess Ashala Malarn. We've also got a wizard, a male wizard, named Hoshtar. He basically represents the Zorlarin house in Mezzobranzan. And last but not least, we've got part of the Brigandarith, we've got Rokalor. So these three actually summon you and basically launch you into giving you basically tasks for this adventure in order to get the Demon Weave up and running. There are also three important factions when it comes to this season's encounters. So we've got the Council of Spiders. Now, since Loth has made that proclamation that she would like to reestablish the Demon Weave, as Derek explained earlier, the male wizards are now trying to secure a position of power within the political aspect of the city. Males, if you remember, in Drow society are pretty much nothing, right? You might get some arcane ones that are arcane from the what was it called, the Arcana, or the
I don't remember.
Yeah, anyway. yeah, so, but anyway, they've established this Council of Spiders, and the Council of Spiders is the representation of all male wizards in Mezzobranzan. So they want to elevate the Council of Spiders because Loth has decreed that magic is going to be an important part of her new power, new order. So the Council of Spiders are there to represent, and they're looking to gain, to establish a foothold. You've also got the priestesses. So the priestesses are now threatened by males. They think that males are lowly and males should remain lowly, and they do not understand why Loth is saying, hey, you know what, let's get a lot more power, but with a lot more arcane power elevates the status of the arcane magic users. And last but not least, we've got the assassins group. So not going to go much more into the assassins group, because if I go into the assassins group, then at that point it's going to give away a lot of stuff. So basically, yeah. Now, what ends up happening is the characters come together, they are assigned their mission, and their mission is to basically go to house, an old house, a fallen house called Sazia, and basically drain the arcane energy from there in order to help fuel the demon weave. Now, you meet up with the three important people. You meet up with the Shalamalarn, you meet up with Hoshtar Zarlarn, and Rokhlor of the Brigandarith. You meet up with all three. They explain the mission to you, and your mission is to go out, activate the ritual, and basically drain the power in order to activate the Demon Weave, or help activate the Demon Weave. Each character is pulled aside. Each character has to basically come up with an affiliation. They have to affiliate themselves with either House Zarlarn, House Malarn, or the Brigandarith. And each one is pulled aside before the mission goes out, and they're given a goal. Now, this is something that's very important. Each chapter is going to have a specific goal for a specific one of those houses. So, for example, House Zarlarn, if you're part of House Zarlarn, Hoshtar will come up to you and say, this is what we want you to do. Make sure nobody else sees you. House Malarn will do the same thing, and the Brigandarith will do the same thing. So each character is given that kind of task, is given a goal, and from there on, we start the adventure.
So now let me jump in. This is probably a good place to talk about worth. So a new mechanic that's been introduced to coincide with the D&D Encounter season we're running this time around is the new Drow Treachery Fortune cards. And the mechanic known as worth. So with the way that this works is this is a way to provide an actual number around popularity, political power, influence, what have you. Basically, you know, what is your life worth in a Drow society? This is a good way for the players to help guide the players in their role playing scenarios. At the beginning of the adventure, there is a table that the DMs have where they can help the players determine what their character's starting worth is. So, like, for example, if you're playing a female character, you get +5 worth right off the bat. If you're a priestess, you get +5 worth right off the bat. If you're a male, you have a negative to your worth, -5. So, if you were, say, for example, a drow, male drow rogue standing next to a female drow priestess, like before anything else is even determined, the difference in their worth is 15 right off the bat. And actions you can take in the adventure will influence your worth, positive and negative. The treachery cards, if played during the campaign, can also influence your worth, positive, negative. And I believe some of the cards will actually affect the worth of the people around you. I know at our table, nobody's using the cards yet because they're not available yet at our store. We didn't get them. But there is certainly a desire to use them. And I have told my guys that if they do want to use them, that's fine. But I've told them that they can't mix and match them with the old fortune cards. You either use just the new treachery cards or just the old fortune cards. It didn't, like, the two mechanics seemed to be a little bit different, so I didn't feel it was appropriate to mix and match them.
Because don't the treachery cards have a worth point written on every single one
of
them? They
do, yeah. So that's why I've sort of told them, like, if you want to use the worth cards, that's fine. Just your deck has to be exclusive one or the other. I don't know if that's correct, but that's how we've decided to run it at the two stores where we're playing, and everybody seems to be on board with it. As far as the actual worth itself, you know, I'm a big supporter of you play the character that you want to play. You play the character the way you want to play them. That's fine. What the worth does is gives you added incentive to play a certain way or not a certain way. And you know, gives you a reason to make certain calls or take certain actions that you might not normally think to take. And I find it was a really good guideline for our players in the first session. You know, the characters that were playing male versus the characters that were playing female, it helped the female characters, the players that were running female characters, exert some dominance over those other players that were playing male characters. Like, normally everyone's all friendly and casual, but this was a good way to have two friends at the table play their characters in such a way that it was clear this character is more important than that character. And as we'll get to later in their description of what happened during the encounter, during the session one, there's a chance after the combat part where they can interact with NPCs. And what I did was I allowed the characters to roll a streetwise check to see if they had heard of these NPCs. And if so, they would have a general idea of what their worth was. And so that way they would know this character's worth is extremely high compared to mine. This character's worth is extremely low compared to mine. And then again, they could use that as a guideline for how they felt it was appropriate to act and react with these NPCs. If they failed the streetwise check, I also let them do an insight check just to determine sort of through body language, personality, is this person acting this way because they have a high worth, or is this person acting this way for some other reason? So between the streetwise and the insight check, obviously one being charisma based and one being wisdom based, it hit the buttons for most of our characters, and they were able to get a pretty good sense of what the NPC's worth was, and they were able to react accordingly. And I think it worked really well. I'm looking forward to seeing how this plays out.
It is very interesting. I think we have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about in the first session anyway. So it's pretty. Yeah, like you said, I'm really looking forward to see how this plays out, because it was very the first session was very, very interesting to start off with.
So actually, while I'm thinking about it, one important change that we decided to make at our game store that is not D&D Encounters, I don't know if we want to say D&D Encounters appropriate, is normally the rule with public play, whether it's LFR or D&D Encounters or Ashes of Athas or any of the public play programs, characters cannot inflict harm on other characters intentionally. So if I've got a power that is all creatures in the burst, I cannot lay that down if it's going to hit somebody else unless the person playing that character consents to the attack. And I understand why they've done this, obviously, because they don't want you fighting each other. Since this is an all drow campaign, like everyone in our game store decided they all wanted to play drow, and given the worth points where you can gain or lose worth depending, like for example, if you attack a female drow, whether you're male or female, you lose worth for that. So we waived that normal rule, and we've said anyone can attack anyone else. If you want to backstab your friend, I don't encourage it, but if you think there's a good reason in game to do it, go for it. You don't have to get their consent. And even during this first encounter, somebody decided that, you know, they were playing a female priestess. They wanted to use a power that was a blast one or a burst one, and they didn't care that there was other characters in the blast. They just went ahead and did it. So, you know, it actually affected how they played the character. And in this particular case, I think it was appropriate. But, I mean, it's not going to work for every group, and I wouldn't encourage it in all circumstances. But I think it'll add a little something to this adventure.
Well, it's funny. I've never heard that rule before. It's great that you bring that up. Myself, personally, as I just sat down, and we have a couple of new players that are very fairly new to D&D, and drow in particular. So we sat there and actually took half an hour, my friend and I. We took about a half an hour to sit down and describe what drow society was like, what Mezzobranzan was all about, some of the novels that they may want to read in order to maybe brush up on how females treat males, et cetera, et cetera. So we did warn them that there is probably going to be some backstabbing, that there will be some damage done, some heavy role-playing to be done, because obviously it is going to be heavy role-playing.
I think that's really a good way that session zero could have been used for groups that might have missed it, is to do exactly what you did. Take the time, especially for new players who maybe aren't as in love with drow as, say, I am. I've read everything that's ever been written that's got drow in it. But a lot of players don't have that background, especially new players. So, yeah, I think that your call to spend some time to do that will certainly pay off for your encounters through the rest of the season.
So when their characters die from a backstab, that they won't be that upset.
Yeah.
Well, you know, well, they're just going to come back next week. So they're just going to come back next week.
Hopefully. I mean, and that's, I think, the big reason why the rule is in there in the first place is you got a guy who comes out to public play for the first time and two of the other PCs attack him or get him, you know, in the crossfire, and he gets killed. He's going to be ticked off. He may not come back. So, true. I mean, I understand why that rule is in place. And we actually had an LFR encounter where before this rule was in place, where a guy blasted someone and he killed one of the players. And the guy basically had to sit there for 2 hours just watching the rest of us because there was no in-game way to bring him back at that point. So, I think in this drow case, it's a good rule to waive, especially if you've got an experienced group.
Yeah, and what I've done, actually, is I've photocopied all the monsters, and if one of the characters die, and I know it's a guy that, you know, really likes his character, et cetera, they know they're going to be able to come back next week with the same character. But what I've done is I've photocopied some of the monsters, and I said, you know what, if they're bored, let's say they get killed off in the first half hour of the encounter. Well, you know what, here's a couple of the monsters. You run them for me. It's, instead of them just kind of sitting there with a finger up their whatever you want to call. Basically give them one or two of the creatures in the encounter and let them have some fun with it.
It's a good idea.
So, anyway.
Back to the encounter.
new word of the season. Digress. No. Anyway, back to the encounter.
Back to the encounter. Sorry, let me jump in here. I'm just looking at the sheet here. We were talking earlier about house goals. One of the things that I didn't do that I wish I had, and I'm going to do this moving forward, is anytime there are goals where they're going to be different, what we did this time around was I had all the people in one group stay at the table and I had everybody else leave the table, and I quietly read them the goal. And then likewise, I had everybody take their turn at the table and away from the table, and it slowed things down considerably. I think moving forward, I'm going to photocopy the page or that has the goals and then cut them out and hand them out, or I'm just going to retype them and print it up multiple times. I think it would have sped up the, especially at the beginning, it took about 10 minutes to go through all that for all three groups. I think that moving forward, as there are additional goals, it might be a good idea for DMs to photocopy that session and have them ready as handouts.
It was very, very quick. That's what I did this week. And it's from talking and, you know, it makes sense. I think we learned from last session, Web of the Spider Queen, where you kind of did your little tests of Loth, right? So that took a lot of time. So if you would have written them down and given them to the characters, it probably would have been better. So yeah. So learned our lesson this time around.
Yeah.
So going into it, the characters go down this hallway. They go down this hallway. They take a nap. They rest for the night. They find where the other excursion. So basically, you're following another excursion, House Labar, Tlabar. Anyway. Something Drow, Tlabar, was sent earlier to go do the same thing. House Tlabar was trying to get ahead of the rest of the houses. This expedition has not returned yet. So they want you to go find this expedition. And with the goals in mind, I'm not going to say what the goals are because then I'll be giving it all away. They end up finding the campsite the first night. They spend the night. And then they kind of walk into a cavern. And this is where the monster cave. They walk into the monster cave, they see a couple of dead bodies on the side, and this is where the encounter starts. Now, how did your encounter start? Did you get boxed in?
Yeah, so I've actually allowed the players, to run the same characters they ran last time. So this party has their methods down, tried and true. And one of the things that they've learned, for better or worse, is that they have decent ranged attacks. So unless they have a reason to advance into a room, 9 times out of 10, they stay in the front door or the front archway or the front path, wherever on the map it says players start here, that's where they stay. And in many of the encounters, it's tough for me as the DM to come up with creative ways to force them into the room, especially when they are coming into a situation like in this case, the monsters are wild, Underdark creatures. Like, this is where they live. This is the creature's home base. This creature would know this area and have plans and tactics where they're going to feel comfortable defending it. And for the monsters to have to leave that comfort zone in order to be offensive against the PCs seemed kind of silly to me. But again, it was the first week. I hadn't really given it too much thought, but I should have learned from last season. And so almost the entire encounter for my group took place in those first 5 or 6 squares. They sort of just stood there. They fought there was an ochre jelly that they could see right in the middle of the room near the front entrance. And then they have amazing perception scores. They were able to find some cave fissures sort of on the walls and on the ceilings around the room. And they basically moved towards the ochre jelly a couple of squares, but they just fired at it. And then I had the ochre jelly, you know, shift up towards them. And so they engaged it in melee because it was big. It could, you know, attack multiple guys. But they made no effort to engage the cave fishers at all. And I had to, have the cave fishers come to them. And by doing that, it really took away from some of the powers the cave fishers had. It was sort of a lackluster encounter. I mean, we had fun, but afterwards, I kept thinking, geez, if only I had come up with a better way to get them into the room. And I thought about a better way after, but I'll let you talk about your thing, and then I'll tell you what I would have done differently.
I personally used the worth to the advantage this time, or I guess I'd explained it properly to the players, because as soon as we got to this room, I had the map laid out, And the priestess automatically told the wizard, the male wizard, the female priestess told the male wizard, get your butt in there and go take a look at what's going on. And he goes, why me? Well, because you're the lowliest of us. And he managed to go in and he failed his perception check wonderfully. But before I continue on that, is what I had done is I don't understand the placement of the map, as you see the map that's posted. I would assume that the cavefisher is probably a nurturing mother. So I ended up putting the cavefisher with all the spawn together around that corner. I kind of gave
that would have made more sense. I wish I had thought to do that.
So I did kind of the family thing, gave him a stealth check, and the ochre jelly, I put him up in the top right corner close to the other entrance. Basically, everything was on the ceiling. I'd given them all a stealth check, and unfortunately, the wizard failed them all. So everybody came in, and at that point, because of the ochre jelly's blind sight, automatically somebody walked into his blind sight and he started charging directly towards it. The cavefishers, they have dark vision, so they kind of heard when the wizard turned around and said, all clear. So the cavefishers kind of went, oh, there's somebody here. Booed. So basically sent the spawn out, and the cavefisher just automatically roped one of the priestesses up. So it was a really tough encounter for my party. Not much resources expenditure, maybe two or three healing surges, two healing surges per person. So it's not too bad. It was actually quite a nice encounter. It was a little bit different. I had the whole party in there. The whole party was all over the place. So it was kind of interesting. So those are some of the changes I made.
So, after the encounter is over and the heroes have defeated the monsters, they notice that there are some drow bodies in the room. Basically, at the beginning of the session, they were told that a party preceded them into this area and they hadn't returned, and they clearly hadn't completed the objective. And so this seemed to be the room where they met their doom. And this is what I would have done differently, is I didn't talk about this at all until the combat was over. And then when you're searching the bodies, you realize that some of the bodies aren't quite dead. And you're able to revive some of the NPCs. And this is where we had our role play, where we used the Worth. And because one of the people that you are able to revive is a priestess, and she's been badly burned by acid from fighting the ochre jelly. And it's, I think they described it, I don't know if I added this detail, if it was in here, it's probably in here, that like her face has been scarred by acid. And I said, like, her, basically she's blinded. She can't see, she had the acid was in her eyes. And so even though she's blind, she still has this sense of entitlement, this arrogance that the priestesses have. Like, you know, just because I'm blind doesn't mean I'm not important. And so, like, she was really trying to boss them around. And at first, they're like, she's freaking blind. Like, we'll just, you know, kill her. And then so I had to really emphasize, like, her worth is through the roof. She is a high priestess here. Like, you know, she is important. Your mission is important. And she is the next most important thing on this. And then there's also another NPC that seemed to be a fighter who you find out basically took no damage during the encounter that the previous party had. Like, he's perfect. He has no damage. He was basically just faking. He was, you know, pretending to be unconscious so he wouldn't get attacked. And so, again, my party, they had to figure, their first instinct was kill him. If he wasn't fighting, there must be a reason for it, and it can't be good. We should kill him. So, again, I had them do that check. Like, what do you think his worth is? Do you know who this is? And then the priestess, of course, was like, he's my guy. He's going to help me get out of here. Don't hurt him. And, again, it was done in such a forceful way that they had no doubt that they should comply. But what I think I would have done differently is, in order to encourage the party to come into the room, I wish I had thought to have the priestess wake up during the encounter, right near the beginning, and call out for help. And that way, I had her at the back end of the room, the PCs at the front of the room, and they could hear this priestess calling for help. And I would have just said, like, one of you recognizes her or sees the symbol from her house, and you know this is a priestess from an important house. If she's asking for aid, it is in your best interest to help her. In fact, if you're a male, it's your duty to help her. And that way they would have had no choice really but to go into the room. And I wish I had thought of that before the encounter started. I think it would have been just enough of a nudge to get them to go into the room and not stay at the front door. I don't know. How did your group play out that interaction after the combat? How did it work with your guys?
We didn't have enough time this week to do it, so I'm going to be doing it at the start of the next session. Yeah. Myself, I never even thought of having these people inside the room. I was going to follow what it says. It says outside the room, down the tunnel a bit, they managed to kind of find a little hidey hole. But that would have been a great idea to kind of spice up the encounter a little bit. That would have been awesome.
Yeah, my other store where I play, we're unfortunately going to be a week behind, so I'm going to get the benefit of some of these learnings that we're going to talk about until we get caught up. But I wish it would have worked. I think it would have worked so much better. Now, one other thing that actually was interesting with our group is I had one of the cave fishers during the combat, the main one. Like it talks about how it sort of stays hidden and then we'll try and attack from range. Well, its range I think was only 5. And with the party staying right near the front door, it couldn't really position itself to get the party without exposing itself by coming around that corner. So it waited and waited and waited and waited. Like, I think 4 or 5 rounds of combat went by before I finally thought, well, if I don't bring this monster in, this party's going to walk all over these monsters, which they were already doing. So I finally had it come out and make a couple of cheap shots at the party. I don't think it actually scored any damage, but the party hit it a few times, bloodied it. So I'm like, well, the creature is a natural creature of instinct. So I had it take off down the other passage. And this was – by the time this monster took off was around the same round when they dropped the ochre jelly and they dropped the last of the minions. And so a couple of the PCs were like, well, geez, we can't let it take off. We're going to try and rest here. Like it could come back and attack us before we get our rest. So they were like, we're going to chase it. We're going to chase it. And I said to them, I'm like, it's up to you guys. You don't like I had them make a dungeoneering check. I think at the beginning of the encounter, they get to make a dungeoneering check to realize like this is going to be a tough encounter. And running away is probably not running away is something you should consider doing if you get in over your head. And so they had made that check earlier. So I'm like, you know enough about these cave fishers and you know how badly you hurt it that it's probably not coming back right away. But a couple of them seemed adamant. They're like, we're going after it. They ended up not going after it. What I had decided was if they chased it, I was going to have them go right into next week's encounter without the short rest. And without specifically saying that, I tried to telegraph it a little bit. Like I said to them, you don't know what's around the corner. It could be other monsters. There could be reinforced, you know, like I mean, I don't think I spelled it out quite that blatantly, but I gave them enough hints to know that there could be additional danger by pursuing them by just blindly running after the creature. So I basically said, okay, we're going to go around the table, everyone on their turn. I need to know yes or no, because if you're pursuing the monster, you need to go right now because it's going to find a little hidey hole and you're never going to find it. I'm like, yes or no, are you going after it? I didn't give them any time to discuss it. And I just went around. It was, you know, no, 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 no. And the last guy was like, okay, fine, I'm not going to. And then I'm like, okay. Your hesitation, the monster is now gone. You're not going to find it. And they were like, oh, okay, that sucks, whatever. But then I told them, I'm like, had you chased it, I would have pushed because, you know, especially after we finished the encounter, because the cliffhanger with this one is they walk into an ambush. So I said that once I read that little cliffhanger, I'm like, if you guys had pursued the cavefisher, you would have had to do the ambush without the rest. And I would have had the cavefisher in the ambush. And they're like, oh,
that would have been cool.
Oh, and I've had in my home game, this is exactly how the DMs play it on us all the time. You know, we chase monsters and we get screwed for it. So they were smart to not chase it. But, you know, it's, those little details, you got to keep those in mind.
Well, the thing that I did also, it has nothing to do with continuing the second encounter, but I had with the placement of the ochre jelly, I knew that this encounter was going to be a little tougher because I had the whole party in the room at this point. Before the party actually engaged the ochre jelly felt the cavefisher move to attack the party. So the ochre jelly, the first thing it did was went up to the cavefisher and attacked it. So then the cavefisher kind of went, oh my goodness, so shifted away and pulled the party men, the priestess, in a little bit harder. And all of a sudden the ochre jelly was attacked by the wizard and it decided to start attacking other people, the more threatening people, right? So it was pretty interesting. The cavefisher actually, the main cavefisher, died from ongoing acid damage by the ochre jelly. So it was it had trouble saving after two or three rounds of ongoing damage. So the module did call that the ochre jelly, if they, you know, it's indiscriminate on who it attacks, and same as the cavefisher and everything like that. So it made for like a three-way battle, the ochre jelly versus the cavefishers versus the party, and that's exactly how it turned out for my party, was one versus the other.
Yeah, I had assumed that if the ochre jelly actually lived in that cavern or had been there for any considerable amount of time, that the cavefishers would have been, like, although they have animalistic intelligence, they would have been smart enough to perceive it as a danger and would know enough to stay away from it. So I didn't have any interaction between the monsters. But given the way it sounds like yours played out, I think that was a good way to handle it.
Well, I had him, remember, I had the ochre jelly just outside the room, right? So it kind of felt the cavefisher move because the cavefisher moved because it felt the party in there, la, 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 la. And it came in and said, oh, food. So yeah, so next week I guess I can just talk briefly about maybe how it happened at my table, but next week, ooh, ambush. So is there anything else you want to add? I guess the reward wasn't that much, right? They got some XP and yeah, that was basically it.
Yeah, I found that this is actually one of the things I like about this adventure over, say, the last season was, in the last couple of seasons, there's been a lot of loot handed out, and we've had a pretty consistent and a pretty small party, and the result was that the party got very rich very quickly. They all had multiple magic items at a very like lower level than you would expect everyone to have swag, and this season looks like it's very light in the magic treasure department. So this week is a good example. You earn XP and you earn worth points, and that's it. And next week, I don't want to ruin anything, but again, no magic treasure. You earn XP, and there's a possible chance you could earn some coins. But depending on how you act, certain things may or may not happen. You may not even get that. So anyone who's hoping to have a Monty Hall-style campaign, you're going to be disappointed. This one is all about the role-playing and the worth points, not so much the material gains.
That's what I'm looking forward to. This encounter, the first one, I guess the only tiny little thing that might be wrong with it is just the placement of the monsters to me, because, you know, it could box in a character and if there's a ranged party, but apart from that, this encounter was pretty much flawless to me.
Yeah, it was good. It again, it unfortunately didn't play out as well as I had hoped that it would, but I think that was just based on the tactics of my group and the party composition. I mean, if you've got a group that's got some melee guys, they're going to run in because nothing bugs a melee character more than staying at the front door when there's no one to hit.
Oh, what about, I guess we didn't explain briefly for when they meet the first expedition. What does the first expedition tell the players? Did you tell them?
I don't remember.
About the, all right. No, but they were supposed to tell them that they were betrayed by one of other priestesses. Yeah.
Sorry, We're playing a week ahead, so I'm a little fuzzy on the details here. Yeah, so I'd mentioned earlier that they find the priestess who's been blinded by the acid and the other guy, and you find out that the party was actually betrayed by a member of their group. It was one of the other priestesses in the group who the party will encounter in a couple of weeks from now if they play their cards right.
Right, so they were backstabbed, left for dead, and now we see what she's up to, I guess, like you said, in the next couple of weeks. So,
yep. Yeah, and then this week ends with the ambush. The PCs, as they head through, they encounter a bunch of the deep gnomes, which is pronounced, how's that one pronounced?
Svirfneblin.
Svirfneblin, yeah, I'm terrible at the pronunciations. The Svirfneblin yell out that... No, they don't yell out till the start of next week's. But basically, as the party comes through, the Svirfneblin ambush them. They drop some. They have a thing set so that the passageway seals behind the party, and they basically have the party boxed in. And that's where session two picks up right with the action.
Yeah, it looks good. So looking forward to next week to play this one. I think it's going to be great. This ends D&D Encounters Season 10 Council of Spiders Session 1 Recaps. And join us next week for Session 2 entitled Miner's Ambush.
You can follow me on Twitter at Amaron_DM. And be sure to visit DungeonsMaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D Encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D encounters. That's 20footradius20ftradius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.